Hello and welcome to episode 117 of the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast. My name is Seth Paradin, historian and deputy director of the Mississippi Armed Forces Museum here at Camp Shelby. And with me, as always, is my esteemed co-host, retired Navy Captain Bill Toedy, former skipper of the fast attack submarine USS Indianapolis, Commodore of Submarine Squadron 3 at Pearl Harbor, and many other postings. How are you this fine morning, Bill?
I'm doing great. I'm trying to learn how to pronounce Matanikau today. So we're going to
You nailed it. You nailed it. Yeah. This week, we'd like to welcome back our friend Dave Holland. Dave is a former United States Marine, owns and runs a Facebook and YouTube channel called Guadalcanal Walking and Battlefield. He's a Solomon Islands battlefield guide. And most importantly, yet again, we said this before, and it rings true every single time, a Guadalcanal expert. Welcome back, Dave. Glad to have you, man.
I'm glad to be back and I'm looking forward to our chat again.
Oh, yeah. We got some good stuff to talk about today. A very inspiring story among many of the inspiring stories around Guadalcanal is one of the ones we're going to hit today. But anyway, back to what we're going to talk about today. This week, we'll be talking about the early actions that occurred along the Matanikau River. Now, as opposed to the land battles we've discussed before, Tenaru and Edson's Ridge specifically, they each only really happened one time, those specific battles. The Matanikau actions, however, occurred several times from September all the way even through November, actually even in August, if you want to be technical. Today, we'll be focusing just on the September and the October actions, however. Following the Battle of Edson's Ridge, what remained of the Japanese force under General Kawaguchi pulled back through the jungle and attempted to regroup as well as refit on the western side of the Matanikau River. Marine General Archer Vandergriff was aware that the Japanese had done this very thing and planned to eliminate whatever was left of that force that had slammed against the ridge on two consecutive nights in September. Vandergriff was determined to mop up what was left of the Japanese so as to deny them the opportunity to consolidate their forces and resume their offensive. Vandergriff chose his freshest troops for this action, those being the recently arrived 1st Battalion of the 7th Marines, under a lieutenant colonel whose name was and still is synonymous with the Corps, Lewis B. Chesty Puller. So, guys, let's talk about the 7th Marines. They're new to the field of battle. They're new to this adventure called Guadalcanal. They were on Samoa before, and they arrive in September, not long after Edson's Ridge, right, Dave?
Yeah, like you said, they were sent out initially because they thought the Japanese were going to continue their offensive through the Southwest Pacific. So they had to garrison the islands very quickly. So the 7th Marines was originally part of the 1st Marine Division, right, one of the three infantry regiments, being the 1st, the 5th, and the 7th Marines. Well, the 7th Marines was fleshed out very quickly with some of the best NCOs and officers in the division because they were thought they were going to be the first to fight, and they shipped them very quickly to British Samoa. So they arrived on Samoa and they joined the 8th Marines there, and some more units and formed one of the, I think, 3rd Marine Provisional Brigade. So they were garrisoned the unit there waiting for the Japanese advance. And so you had Puller, H.H. Hannigan, and other legends it seemed to be, but they were two of the biggest legends at the time. So they were in the 7th, and then obviously, the 1st Marine Division's, the rest of the regiments were the first to fight on 7th of August. So you can imagine how Puller and Hannigan and a lot of these veteran NCOs, thinking they were going to be the first to fight, kind of missed the show. So when they arrived on the 18th of September, they were ready to and raring to go with the fight. In fact, one of the good stories about Puller, it's told several different versions, but when Puller landed, his version was he landed on the beach. First thing he said was, "Where's the Japanese?" And someone handed him a map, and he looked at the map, and he says, "Oh, I can't make heads or tails of this. Just point me out where the Japanese." And they pointed to the hills. He said, "That's where I'm going." Another story, especially by Lieutenant Colonel Twining, one of his good friends, Earl Twining, made him on the beach. He said, "Oh, Puller, about time you showed up. You know, you missed the fight. About time you showed up. Where you been? Sitting on the beach somewhere?" And they all started laughing at him.
In Samoa, there are worse places to sit on the beach.
Yes. But the 7th Marines were the first real big reinforcement that Vandergriff had received. Mm-hmm. So they were very well trained, very fresh. And it gave him his full complement with his division, even though he did have the 2nd Marine Regiment, which was loaned to him, but they were mainly garrisoned Tulagi at the time. But he gave him that chance, like you mentioned, Ford, to actually have a 364 perimeter.
Right.
And also give him a bit of offensive element, fresh unit, so he could push out and support his active defense.
And there's a bunch of logistics that arrived with him too, right?
Yes.
Finally, after being this austere conditions the Marines were operating under before this.
Right.
Oh, yeah. There was about 4,000 guys landed. I mean, it was also, there was a whole battery of or battalion of the 11th Marines, which was the artillery. They were attached with them, a lot of engineer units. When they landed, the parachute battalion left. There wasn't much of them. There's a whole manifest list I have, and it was just amazing. It was the first big resupply, and the two meals a day that the Marines were on kind of ceased, and they started eating.
Three meals again. Normally you could call it, but I'm confused again. But the para battalion, the para Marines were first on Tulagi, right? And were they split? Was there some on Guadalcanal as well?
Well, they pulled them off.
They were Gavutu and Tanimbogo, which
okay. Right, right.
7th and 8th of August, they hit there. And then they merged with the 1st Raider Battalion.
But okay.
By the time of after Bloody Ridge, and there wasn't much left of them. They'd been decimated because they weren't the full battalion size anyway when the battle started.
A couple of companies. Okay.
Yeah, probably you say three or four companies on normal strength size. I forgot the exact number. They were down to less than probably 100. They got on the ship.
Incredible.
It's important to note, and you mentioned it here just a second ago, Dave, is that the arrival of the 7th is the first major reinforcement. They'd gotten people here and there. And like you said, you know, we talked about in another episode, they brought the Raiders over, the Paramarines came over from Tulagi and Gavutu and places like that. But this is the first real sizable reinforcement. And not only did they bring men, they brought some supplies. You know, the food instances were one thing. They brought some vehicles. They being the, you know, that convoy with 7th Marine brought some vehicles. They brought some fuel. This is the first major reinforcement for the Marines there. And the big thing to note here is what you said earlier, is it allowed Vandergrift to form a 360-degree perimeter. And that's something I think people don't understand, is that, you know, up until this time, they didn't have enough people to do that. You know, Vandergrift did not have enough people to properly defend the area that they had captured. Now he does. And not only does he have that ability to defend, he also, as you said, Dave, he's got the ability to kind of get out there and poke the bear a little bit here, which is something he does in very short order. He sends the 7th out pretty quickly. But before we get to that, we talked about Chesty Puller. He is, you know, when people think of the United States Marine Corps, he's probably one of the first guys that they think about.
He's iconic, yeah.
He is. He or was. He, you know, and it's not that, you know, the Marine Corps is not short of legendary heroes, but it's just that Puller, for whatever reason, is the one of the first people that people think about.
Well, he was Hollywood. I mean, he's a Hollywood, you know, he looked the part, he acted the part, he played the part.
He was a Marine's Marine. He really was.
And he had the courage. And as you said, Dave, where's the enemy? That's where I'm going.
Yeah.
So, you know, from beginning to end, he was an iconic Marine.
So when he lands on Guadalcanal, he's 44 years old at the time. He is. He's 44. Correct. He joins the Marines in 1918. Chesty Puller does.
And he was born in 1900. So he was 18 years old when he joined. And this is, that doesn't work.
No, 1898. Yeah. 1898.
Yeah.
So he'd served 24 years in the Corps by the time he arrives on Guadalcanal. And he is not your green as grass CO. He had seen actions in the Banana Wars in Haiti and Nicaragua. He'd gotten at least one, or did he get two of his Navy crosses before?
Two Navy crosses in the Banana Wars. Yeah. He was already a legend before he even arrived on Guadalcanal.
Right. He was, there was a description that I read that Martin Clemens wrote of him, of Chesty Puller. He said he was a prototypical Marine Corps officer. He had a chin like a bulldozer blade, a barrel chest, and seemingly always had a pipe stuck in his mouth. And he does. If you look at pictures of him, more often than not, he's chewing on a pipe. And he's got this, I mean, you know, it's very abundantly clear why he got the name Chesty. It looks like he's got a beer barrel around his chest. And he's not fat. He's just, he's built like, you know, a Marine Corps bulldog. The thing is with Chesty Puller, and I knew a lot of Seventh Marines who served under him, and I know you did at some point too, Dave, that everyone who served underneath that man absolutely adored him, from officers to privates. I mean, they worshiped the ground that he walked on and would do anything that he asked of them without hesitation. And I mean, that is the sign of an excellent, excellent, excellent leader, that you can command that kind of dedication without really doing much aside from just walking around and being one of the guys, you know?
Yeah, he was an enlisted Marines officer, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he was not wanting to jump ahead, but he ends up being in just about every major battle in the Pacific theater of operations, right?
The first Marines up until, once again, most of them did three campaigns, mm-hmm. and then they were sent back either to the States or to do something else. They'd get them out of combat. So Puller served up into Peleliu. And then once again, Peleliu is another story, and you guys will get to that a bit later than what happened to Puller on Peleliu. Mm-hmm. But Puller, we'll find out later in our discussion with some of the guys in the second time, the 5th Marines at the mouth of Matanikau, how they felt. But we'll lead into a bit later.
Yeah, if there's one blemish on Puller's World War II record, it would be Peleliu. And that's in my professional opinion, he and again, we're getting a little far ahead, but he pushed the 1st Marine Regiment. You know, he bled them white on the Umar-Brogel, but that's another conversation for another day.
Yeah.
Back to Guadalcanal. So Puller gets there. Vandergrift immediately decides to utilize his people and assigns Puller a mission. Dave, let's talk about this mission. This is just before the September crossing of the Matanikau. Actually, this is what results in the September crossing of the Matanikau. What is his mission that Vandergrift tells him he wants him to do? What does he say? Hey, Puller, do this. What does he talk?
All right. So Puller, being probably the best trained battalion that he had, because I call him, he wanted a battalion to kind of replace the Raiders. He had the Raiders there at the time, but Raiders were starting to get spin out. So he wanted his good maneuver battalion under a good aggressive commander. So 1-7 fit the bill. So he sent 1-7 basically on reconnaissance in force. So he had, on Guadalcanal at the time, I think we discussed it before, you had one, I wouldn't really call it a road. They call it a track. It was the government track or coastal track. And he went obviously up the coast. Then to another time, parallel in that, at the slopes, northern slopes of Mount Austin, or the grassy knoll, as it was called, the initial part of the campaign. There was east-west trail. I can't pronounce it in Japanese, but the Japanese had a word for it. I can't pronounce it. It started with an M. You know, that was the main trail that the Japanese had used, especially Kawaguchi's brigade, on the withdrawal back to the Matanikau. And that east-west trail basically went from the Lunga River, which was in the Marine perimeter. It went in a westerly, from east to west, as the Marines traveled it, parallel in the coastal track on the other side of a major ridgeline. So basically, his task was to go down that east-west trail, following the same track that the Japanese had retreated down. Once he went there, crossed the Matanikau River. There's two crossing points, but the main crossing point was at the sandbar. That's where the government tracked went over the Matanikau. The Japanese, probably about 1,500 to 1,600 yards upstream, had the Nippon Bridge, or the one log bridge. It was a large banta tree. And you know, the banta trees, you've probably seen photos of them in Guadalcanal, is just a large jungle top tree. And it had been felled over to Matanikau in a small, narrow part. And that was where the Japanese had crossed back and forth. So the east west trail went there, and it went down into a place called the Valley. And later in the story, we'll talk about the Valley, which was made famous in a book called Into the Valley by John Hersey, a war correspondent. So it went into the Valley, and it went down into the Matanikau to cross the bridge. So what Puller was going to do, reconnaissance in force, go down the east-west track, cross the Matanikau. Once he hit the Matanikau, then the 1st Raider Battalion, that was the signal for them to advance down the coastal track, basically paralleling, meet up with Puller, push through 1-7, and go to a place called Kukumbona, which was a village probably another 4 miles down eastern side, or sorry, the western side of the Matanikau. Mm-hmm. And there they will form a patrol base. And
the first it's on the eastern side of the Matanikau, right?
Oh, western, to western side of Matanikau.
Okay.
Yeah, but Kukumbona Village.
Kukumbona, so that was right.
Yeah, the Japanese had been landed there, and that was kind of their central focus point.
Okay.
So what Vandegrift wanted to do, he wanted to push the Japanese far away from the airfield to mm-hmm. give them a bit of a buffer zone. And he thought if he could form a major patrol base at Kukumbona, that would keep the Japanese well, especially on the western side, well far away from the airfield. And that was his intent.
So Puller and 1-7 are traveling west when they cross the Matanikau?
Yeah, they're going down the east-west trail, traveling west across the Matanikau. Once they cross Matanikau, then the first raiders are going to come through and form a major patrol base at Kukumbona.
Okay. So how far inland are they when they're doing this?
I'd say less than a mile. I'd say probably about a mile.
Okay.
A mile from the coast. So you're going from the coast.
You're far enough to get lost in the jungle. That's kind of the point.
Oh, yeah. So they're on the northern slopes. I mean, I wish I had a map, but the northern slopes mm-hmm. of Mount Austin.
Right.
So they're basically traveling on the slopes. That was a Japanese trail that had built, the east-west trail.
Mm.
So they're traveling down there, and they took off about the 23rd of around the 23rd of September. That's when they punched out.
Got it.
Now you said it was a reconnaissance in force, and it certainly was that. I mean, he being Vandegrift, put out several hundred guys in this reconnaissance in force, and it's, you know, they move out on the 23rd, and on the afternoon of the following day, so this would be 24 September, the lead elements of Puller's group, they ran into a Japanese bivouac area on the northwestern slope of Mount Austin, and then there's a pretty sharp firefight right there. And there, it's pretty nasty, pretty quick.
Yes, yeah, I've been to that site. There was a couple of areas. He had two companies. So Puller, being a banana war marine, especially in that thick jungle, Puller always led from the front. Well, I wouldn't say he was the front guy, but he was like the fourth or fifth back. Probably not the best place for a battalion commander. Once again, these are well-trained but green troops. And Puller was the guy who always wanted to be up front, and he could, if we hit an ambush, he could react very quickly, deploy his forces very quickly. So they were traveling in Indian file. So he had a whole battalion, roughly. He'd left his heavy guns back, such as the heavy machine guns and his 81-millimeter mortars. He'd left them back, but he had the rest of the battalion there. So they're traveling in single file. Puller was probably about four, five, or six person back. And he had a few flankers out, and Puller's with the scouts. So they came upon some rice cooking over fire, or had rice fires going. I think they flushed out, as Puller called it, a few Japanese, and they ran away, and they left their cooking fires with their rice. And the story was that Puller had seen the rice, bent down and started sampling some of it, said, "This isn't bad rice." And that's when machine guns started opening up. And apparently, I don't know if this has been confirmed or it's just a good Marines war tale, but one of the bullets hit the rice pot that Puller was eating out of. And then that started the firefight, and he had his two companies, and he started maneuvering in his companies at A and B. He started doing the enveloping and flanking movements.
And he'd only been ashore about, what, 5 days at this point?
They landed on the 18th, yeah.
Yeah, so
before they landed, they sent them the next day. They sent them on. They sent them up to man the Bloody Ridge area, and that's where the 7th always manned that southern line. And Puller and naturally the Raiders had done a small reconnaissance patrol up the Lunga River. But yeah, they used them from the second day.
So and this wasn't just skirmishing. This was fairly rigid attack, wasn't it?
It was.
And the thing was. And this will play into what happens after that, is that Puller's people take some pretty significant casualties. They lose seven guys there. And by lose, I mean killed in action. And then there's 25 wounded. So, I mean, that's, you know, that's mm-hmm. fairly significant for a little short, sharp action. And I guess you could call it a victory because the Marines do push the Japanese out of this area. But that's a lot of people to lose in a very short amount of time towards the end of a day. And that hinders things from here on out. The next part of this operation was that 2-5 plays an important part in this, don't they, Dave?
Yeah. So I'll take one step back there. Mm-hmm. when I'm on the battlefield in that area, I tell that story. I take some of the guys up on the ridge and I point out where this occurred. And then I mentioned that Puller sent two whole companies back with his wounded. Mm-hmm. He had 25 wounded, so he sent roughly over 200 men back with him. And I could tell very quickly the ones who I'm giving this tour to or giving this information to that's never actually carried a stretcher carry through the jungle. Because generally in every group, there's someone that says, well, why did they take 200 guys that carry about 25? And I know right off the bat that person's never carried a stretcher. Mm-hmm. Even on a flat 100 yard football field, because it's very hard work. And these guys, that was the days before obviously the helicopters, there was no roads, they couldn't get jeeps up to them. So they're at that stage, they're probably a good mile, if that, from the perimeter. So they had to carry these guys back. Then they had to rotate the four stretcher carriers. Then they had to provide security. So that's why he sent back two of his two out of his three companies and left him with C company. And then 2-5, he basically got a message back to Vandegrift, and Vandegrift said, Puller, do you want to pull back or continue? And Puller's basically being Puller. He goes, I want to continue, obviously, but I need some more, more help here.
So yeah, I helped carrying a stretcher on 9/11 at the Pentagon, and just a couple hundred yards over open grass, there were six of us, and it beat the heck out of me. And it's just, I can't imagine doing it through jungle.
It'll wear you out.
Yeah,
and you would have been under a lot of adrenaline too, I imagine, sir. So
absolutely,
a hard thing.
So 2-5 does. He requests Puller requests. I'm losing reinforcements. There we go. Sorry, brain sludge. 2-5 does come up, and but at the same time, the Japanese had established a defensive position around the one log bridge. I love that Rich Frank describes one log bridge. He says, and I'm paraphrasing, he says it was called one log bridge because, comma, well, it was.
It was one log.
So they consolidated that evening. They buried their dead, and I've been to the area where they buried the dead. So they buried the dead on some hilltops. They consolidated there, and then they moved out the next morning. So they moved out the next morning, which is the 25th. So they moved down and they moved past the area where the one log bridge was. At that stage, there was no Japanese there. Mm-hmm. So they moved down. It's changing a little bit of fire, a couple of mortar rounds and a few rifle rounds, but there was no active.
No fight, yeah.
So they've passed the area of the one log bridge. There's no Japanese there. And they continue down to the mouth of Matanikau. And basically that's where they arrived with 2-5 and C Company. Once they arrived there, then they called for the 1st Battalion, or sorry, the 1st Raiders to join them. And then after the Marines had passed that area, then Japanese pushed a whole, not a whole company, but a number of Japanese, roughly a reinforced platoon, across the river. And left the other two platoons. I think it was the 9th company or the 12th company or the 124th.
Yeah.
Which was the guys, our friend, old friend, Colonel Oka. Mm-hmm. Yep. We visited in the last episode.
Yeah, it's the 12th company is the guys that are on that side of the river. And like you said, Puller heads downstream. He's headed towards the mouth of the river, and they attempt a crossing right there. Is it 2-5 is put it, they're at the front, are they not?
Yeah, 2-5's the guys that try to push across. Yeah, mainly E and G companies.
Mm-hmm. And they're met by some pretty heavy fire, aren't they? On by the Japanese. The Japanese throw a lot of lead on that other side of the river, don't they?
Yeah, just like I mentioned before, the main crossing point pre-war and at that stage too was the sandbar, which became quite famous throughout the campaign. The sandbar of the Matanikau. So that was the main area that the Marines tried to push across. So the Japanese had that dug in quite well, one of the other companies of the 124th, and they met a lot of resistance, and they suffered a lot of casualties. And that's why if you speak to a lot of the veterans of the 2nd Battalion of the 5th Marines, are not that well impressed with Puller, because they didn't know Puller. Puller wasn't their battalion commander. This is the first time most of them had ever met him. And they said, this guy's just trying to kill us. He's trying to push us across this river. You know, obviously, we're getting hit, But once again, that's from a private PFC's point of view. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they don't see the big picture. Only thing they know is that someone's just sending them off to get killed. So obviously, sometimes aggressive tactics work. Sometimes they don't work. In this case, they're working.
You've got 2-5. You've got the elements of 1-7 that are left after he sends two companies back with his wounded. And you've got some Raiders?
The Raiders were coming up at this stage. They hadn't arrived on the scene, but they'd been called up.
But Puller's in overall command because Edson hasn't arrived yet?
Yes, this stage, he is in overall command.
Okay.
And then we just have the Sabre Battalion 5th Marines and the C Company are the ones.
All right.
Once the next day, on the 27th at first light, the Raiders are there by now, are they not, on the 27th?
Yeah, I think they arrived on the afternoon of the 26th.
Yeah, and when that comes, when they come in, Merritt Edson of Edson's Ridge, he is an overall command. He takes over for Puller, does he not?
Yeah, so he becomes overall command and makes Puller his kind of executive officer.
His XO, yeah.
Oh, he's senior to Puller? I didn't realize that.
Yeah, he's a colonel. He's a full colonel.
Oh, Puller's
lieutenant colonel. Lieutenant.
That's right.
When Puller took over 1-7, I think in 40-41, he was a major.
Well, so they get on the morning of the 27th, the Raiders are now, they are trying to push back towards the one log bridge area and cross the river there, right?
Yeah, so basically what happened was the information got back to the D3, which is the planning. At that stage, it was Twining. Twining had taken over from Thomas. Thomas then became the shaking up of the house, so to speak. Caper James was the chief of staff for Vandegrift. So he made Thomas, who was the planning's officer, he made him his chief of staff. Twining come up as D3. So Twining come up with a quick plan on the run, they called it. It wasn't a bad plan. So the plan was the Second Battalion of the 5th Marines under Puller was going to basically push across the mouth of Matanikau in a holding action to trap and hold those Japanese there. The Raiders were going to come down, cross at the one log bridge, and do an envelopment, hit the Japanese on the right flank. And at the same time, once the word that the Raiders had crossed the Matanikau, then the other elements of Puller's battalion, which was back at the perimeter, which we had A, B, which is the two rifle companies, and elements of D Company, which was the weapons companies, under a fellow named Ortho Rogers, who was the battalion executive officer. They were then going to take amphibious assault
and envelop from the
envelop from the rear on the western side of Point Cruz and coming from behind the Japanese. So you'd have the Japanese trapped in a pocket, then they were going to wipe the pocket out. So that was an overall quick plan they did.
Mm. But as all plans usually, as was told to me several times, you know, plans
never
are great.
Survive contact with the enemy.
There it is. And that's exactly kind of what happens here. The Raiders go down and they run smack into those Japanese that are sitting on the other side of that river, and it starts to get pretty nasty pretty quick. The Raiders, for all their expertise in infantry combat, as was shown on the ridge, they run smack into a hard defense and they are pinned down. They're the Japanese are holding them down right there, and they're unable to really do much of anything right there.
Back on the airfield, it was a major air raid, and one of the Japanese bombs hit one of the radio networks and knocked out their command and control, so to speak. And obviously, in the confusion of combat, the word had got back to the command and control back at the division headquarters that the Raiders were across the river. The Raiders had made it across
the river. They had succeeded, so move on to the next phase.
Yep, so that was the signal.
But it wasn't true.
Amphibious hook. Okay. So the amphibious guys in Fort. In fact, Ortho Rogers, who's on a Sunday. Ortho Rogers, I'll mention Ortho Rogers now. He was kind of a tragic case, what happened to him, and we'll discuss it in a minute. But he was the executive officer of Puller. So Puller wasn't an admin guy. He wasn't a paper man, he used to say. So he obviously, as being a good commander, what he did, he put someone underneath him. He was the the admin and the paper man, which was Ortho Rogers. He was kind of the staff officer, the personnel, the admin officer for Chester Puller. Puller was the fighter, and you know, he didn't want to do the paperwork. And I think Puller actually said paperwork will ruin any good military force. And mm-hmm. and Hannikin was the same way. Hannikin was the other battalion commander, 2-7. They were both banana war guys. So he was
imagine what if Puller would have had to put up with if they had PowerPoint back then.
He wouldn't have survived. Those old guys. Survive.
Yeah, we are men of action. We don't do PowerPoint. Yep.
Yeah. Oh, geez, I'm not going to imagine it. But Ortho Rogers was the worked for the Postal Service in Washington, D.C. He was a good reserve officer. He's a good trainer, apparently. So anyway, Ortho Rogers he was in the church service back at the Lunga Primary. He got out of his fatigues and put on his nice tan dress shirt. And boots, yeah. And yeah, he was getting mm-hmm. ready for a church service. And these guys were told very quickly, okay, jump on the boats, jump on the boats. So he's still in his good Sunday, I guess, best you could call it. And they gave a quick briefing to his two captains mm-hmm. and they got on the boats. And then the boats were at Cookham, which was the boat basin. And the boat basin, this is where the U.S. Coast Guard comes in. Many are aware the U.S. Coast Guard fought overseas in many a campaigns, and especially in World War II. You know, mm-hmm. they were the guys manning all the boats. So in this case, the Coast Guards manned the landing craft. And he had a USS Monson. Sometimes on some of the old documentation, I think it's the Ballard or something. I think it's a Ballard or something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah, there's a mix up there. The Marine Corps or the Navy actually said post-war battle maps of the area, they called it the USS Ballard. And it was not. It was absolutely, it was the USS Monson.
Monson.
Or Monson. Yeah. Yeah, you're right.
Well, Monson was obviously given, they were given some naval gunfire support. And they had been up there on the first day, kind of soften up some of the Japanese positions. So the Monson was hanging offshore. And then he had a Cookham boat basin. And he had these boats ready to go under the Coast Guard. And Puller, is this the time to mention when the Puller goes back or says?
Yeah, yeah. So well, mm-hmm. well, let's kind of set the stage a little bit, because this is an incredible story here. And it's true. This is not a myth. This is
yeah.
This
most
is
of Puller's incredible stories are true. That's the amazing thing
yeah,
about
but
him.
This is just badass, straight up. Mm. So they're under, and again, this kind of set the stage. The Japanese are holding off the raider assault upstream over there by the One Log Bridge area. 2-5 is basically stopped right there at the sand spit right there at the mouth of the river. There's been a screwed up communication that the Marines back at the perimeter think that Puller is across, or Edson rather, is across the river. That is not the case. They send these Marines down, and they are from 1-7, the A Company, B Company, and D Company, to do the amphibious assault, the envelopment that we had talked about earlier. And again, David, just to set it up, the USS Monson is escorting, was it 10 or like 12 landing craft, something like that. It's close to a dozen landing craft, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, it was the normal landing craft. I think a couple of tank lighters, they called them at the time. Yeah. So basically, when the first Marines landed, they didn't meet a fire from the beach. They landed unopposed, so to speak. And as soon as they landed, they were a few hundred yards off. So Ortho Rogers wanted to know what was going on. So if you go to Guadalcanal to this day, where all the main tourist hotels are, was roughly the beach where they landed. Mm-hmm. So they landed. They went to the first high ground, which is Hill 84 or Lankiki Ridge, as some of the people who live in Honiara today might know it. So they went up to the first, then when they went through, they was passing a Japanese bivouac, but they didn't see too many Japanese around. They said, what is these Japanese? They made it up to the top of the ridge to find out what was going on. Then that's when the Japanese Oka had formed a plan. He had one company on the other side of the Marines, and he had the company that was at the mouth. He sent some of those guys back to try to trap the Marines. He said, we got them in a trap now. And then they started especially hitting the Marines on Hill 84 on the eastern point. That's when they started taking a lot of fire. Unfortunately for Ortho Rogers, in the very opening stages of this major fight, he called a command group with his two captains and some of his lieutenants. And One of the veterans had pointed out the area later where this occurred, because he was a sergeant at the time. He was walking up to this command group. And if you go into my one of my videos, it's called The Little Dunkirk Action. I actually show you in there where Ortho Rogers, where this incident occurred. So Ortho Rogers had called his command group together, and the eyewitness reports was a Japanese knee mortar round landed basically right between Ortho Rogers' feet. Basically almost literally blew him in half and severely wounded one of the other captains and a couple of the other Marines. So they were down their command right off the bat. And then the Japanese started hitting them left and right. So they were all pinned down.
And this is almost, I mean, this is within a few minutes.
Yeah, we probably about 15 or 20 minutes after they land to make top of the ridge and work out what was going on. Then the Japanese trap just closed in on them.
Boom. Yeah. And they're surrounded pretty quickly. Really, there's a guy named Charles Kelly, Captain Kelly. He assumes command after Rogers is killed. And help me out here, Dave. He tries to, or decides to radio for help, but they didn't bring their radios, did they?
No, there was a sergeant named Raisbrook. He was one of the main communicators, and he left the in the haste. And you think, well, how can this happen? But sometimes, obviously, there wasn't that planned. Everything. This plan was on the fly, so to speak, and these things kind of happen. Radios in those days wasn't that great anyway. I mean, sometimes the radios, it wasn't like modern radios, even radios in the Vietnam era, where you at least you had a PRC 25 on your back. You can, man, these things were large. It took three or four guys to carry them, and they wasn't that lightweight. And they did have the walkie-talkies, they call them, but they mainly relied on field phones or field phone wires in those days. So the radios wasn't that reliable, but nevertheless they didn't carry any communication with them apart from some flags. So they've landed there, they're trying to get the message back that we're trapped. The vision don't know what's going on. Even Edson and Puller don't even know what's going on. So they're in a pretty bad pickle right now.
So they do something that again, it sounds like it's something out of a movie, but it's true. They start, they being the Marines, basically write a signal in the ground using their clothing and what fabric they have to spell out the word help. And it just so happens that there is an SBD, a Dauntless Dive Bomber, airborne at that time from VMSB 231, piloted by a guy named Dale Leslie, who is in the air. You can see the battle going on. He looks down and he sees the word help.
Is he there to provide close air support, or just is he in transit?
I think he was in transit. I do not believe, because he was not armed. From what I've been able to find when I was able to read about him and his specific orders, is that he was not armed. His aircraft, or if it was armed, it expended its ammunition. And by that I'm talking about bombs. And to your point, Dave, they have machine guns on that, but that's not why he was there. He just happened to be there at that time. It's one of those right place, right time kind of moments. He sees this notification, help, hey, hello, please, and immediately he relays that message via radio or he has his rear seat man do that immediately. He doesn't even wait to get back to Henderson Field. He says, hey, there's a problem going on down here, y'all need to do something about this, and you need to do something about it now, essentially, is what he says.
And word gets to division, and then division figures out, well, those are Puller's people. Well, is that how it goes down?
I'm a little confused here too, because I read three different accounts that said three different things at the same time. Mm-hmm. That the SBD pilot sends a message. That is without a doubt. That's yes, absolutely 100%. Puller hears the message from Edson. And then I've also read that Vandergrift heard, not Vandergrift. You mentioned him before, the communications officer back there at the perimeter, Thomas.
Well, Thomas was chief of staff here.
Somebody back there in Edson's headquarters hears it. And, there's kind of a thing going on, because, we didn't think that this was going on. And there's a bit of commotion here. I don't really think that there is any kind of definite answer, but the word does get back to Chesty Puller that your people are surrounded over here on this hill and things are going south pretty quickly. Go ahead, Dave. Go ahead.
Yeah, so basically, the word had got back to Puller. Puller was then spoke to Edson. He says, well, my battalion's trapped. Let's keep pushing and pushing. That's my boy, so to speak. I think, obviously, I'd love to have been a fly on the wall in the command post at that stage. But it obviously, Edson, for some reason, I think he was just trying to work out a plan, but it wasn't quick enough for Puller. Edson says, no, I'm not pushing across. I'm not sending 2-5 across the river. Let me just think about this. He says, you're not leaving my guys to die. So I think Puller just took it upon himself. He went back to Cookham. I guess he jumped on a Jeep or a truck and made it back very quickly where the boat basin was. He met the Coast Guard. He says, we're going back to get my guys out. Then he jumped on the USS Monson. He took a launch out to the destroyer of the Monson.
And he's not by himself when he does this, is he?
Yeah.
He is. Oh, wow.
Yeah. He just left the battlefield, jumped on, basically got in a boat, went to the boat basin, and got on the Monson. Mm-hmm. And Puller, you know, being a former ship, a Marine detachment on the ship, knew how to operate on the ship and everything like that. So he got on the ship, met the captain, met the Coast Guard landing guys and said, follow me, let's go. And apparently it was like ducks in a row. And there was a destroyer laden and the other landing craft. And they're going to get the guys out. Puller basically in conjunction with the Navy captain of the ship.
And the only way you could talk to the guys on the beach is by semaphore at this point?
They haven't got there yet. But
Oh, wow.
As they're getting there, and this is what's so damn cool about this, is this Puller just says, the hell with this. I'm going to get my people. He gets on this friggin' destroyer, and just they go out there, and they're going to make this rescue happen. As they are pulling up near the area, the Monson is met by pretty significant Japanese ground fire coming from the beach. At this point, the Monson starts to respond to that fire.
Return fire.
And that is 100% correct that Puller does make contact with Kelly, or at least with Kelly's people, via semaphore. Do you know the exact story of that, Dave? I mean, it was literally, sending signals via signal flags.
So Raisbrook, the guy I mentioned before, it left the radio, Sergeant Raisbrook. Mm-hmm. I guess, I don't know if he was volunteered or in his guilt or whatever. He was obviously being a communicator. In those days, they knew semaphore flags, which is a signal flag.
Morse code semaphore and everything else.
Yeah, so you probably knew it there too, sir. So he was well-versed in it. So he basically, on my little Dunkirk video, I actually showed the site where he was standing. So he gets up on the ridge under extreme fire, and he starts signaling the destroyer. And basically, he goes back and forth. And I've read stories that Puller was doing the signaling, which I really don't believe in on this ship. They had expert communicators for that.
No, that's right.
Puller's directing it.
The signalman on the destroyer would have been able to do it. So
exactly. They're the
far faster than Chesty Puller could have done.
Absolutely. Exactly. Yeah.
So I have no doubt Puller's standing there saying, tell this man this.
Exactly. Give him this message. Right. Okay.
And basically, Puller's coordinating the landing craft, trying to get the landing craft. And I'll mention the semaphores, but they're basically saying, lay the fire here and lay the fire here. Basically, a corridor. Give me a corridor of 5-inch rounds. Mm-hmm. And they're landing on the left flank and landing on the right flank. So they need a corridor of rounds to hold the Japanese off, so they could retrograde off that ridge back to the beach and get evacuated. Mm-hmm. So they started laying down some effective 5-inch rounds, and the Marines started peeling off the top of that ridge, one company at a time. So only two companies, really, and one company at a time. They started fighting their way out of there. At this stage, some of the landing craft was hesitant to go in because they were getting a lot of enfilade fire. So if you look at the area, especially on the map, you got Point Cruz, which juts
out. It's concave, right?
Yeah, and it juts out. Mm-hmm. And the Japanese were on the Point Cruz Peninsula. Mm-hmm. And they were firing enfilade fire, machine gun fire, from both
angles. From both sides.
Yeah, on the Marines and on the landing craft. And the landing craft get hit. And these are Coast Guard guys. And it's the first time these guys have ever been in combat, these Coast Guard guys. I mean, under direct fire. So they were a bit hesitant. So I think there was a few choice words there. And then you had the leader of the Coast Guard, which was, I think he was a petty officer at the time, Douglas Munro. So he was the leading Coast Guard of the landing craft. Mm-hmm. He was the leading guy in charge of the landing craft. So they started pushing to evacuate these Marines.
Yeah. As the Marines are getting off of that hill, and this is consistent with everything that it's happened so far, as they're pulling off of that hill, the fire, as you said, Dave, it's growing in intensity, the Japanese fire, because they realize that the Marines are trying to get out of there. They can see, I mean, you can literally see the destroyer blasting a path. So it gets even nastier as they're coming off the hill. Douglas Monroe, he orders his Higgins landing craft to go. We're going to go get these people. We're going to go get them right now. He's up on the, if you've ever seen an LCPL, this is not the Higgins landing craft with the ramp. This is the one before that, the model before that.
You go over the side.
Yeah, yeah. You go over the side, and there's two positions up forward on the bow. And at that time, they were armed with machine guns. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that Douglas Monroe was manning a 1928 Lewis gun, which is a freaking cool weapon anyway. But I mean, that, you know, as they're pulling up close to the shore, Monroe is the one sitting in his position in the bow of the boat, and he is laying down fire with this Lewis gun to provide covering fire so these Marines can get up on the boat, up in the boat rather. And he keeps his boat there for a very long period of time under direct fire, does he not?
Oh yes, they were probably about 150, 200 yards off. He was there providing a fire. There was there was one of the boats that was actually stuck on a sandbar. Mm-hmm. So it was trapped. So you know, he's really putting himself between that trapped boat and the Japanese. Mm-hmm.
There's Marines in the water, and they're trying to free this trapped landing craft, and that's why Monroe puts his boat up in between there. He decides he's going to use his boat and his body
as a shield,
to give these Marines some time to get this other landing craft, which is also under his command, by the way, to get it out of there and get it the hell away from the beach. He holds that station for several minutes. It's not known exactly how long, but it's just, must just suffice it to say, it's several minutes, pouring fire back at the Japanese. And eventually they do free this grounded boat and they start to pull away. At that point, Monroe's craft, he orders it to come about and withdraw. And as they do so, he is struck in the base of his skull right there and knocks him unconscious. It eventually, obviously, it kills him, but it knocks him unconscious. He falls from his position as the boats are pulling away. Rushing back to Lunga Point, his best friend, Monroe's best friend, is a guy named Raymond Evans, who's actually, I believe Raymond Evans was driving the boat, if I'm not mistaken, right, Dave?
He was the coxswain.
Yeah, he's coxswain. The coxswain. He's driving the boat. And these two guys were like, you know, yin and yang. They were pals. They called them the Gold Dust Twins. They were everywhere they went. The other one was not far behind. So Evans sees Monroe go down, and they haul ass back to the area. And it's almost, again, it's like something out of a movie. As they're pulling up to the area, Monroe, just for a very, very brief period of time, regains consciousness, asks Evans, did they get off? And he's referring to the Marines, of course. And Evans replies in the affirmative. He says, yeah. And Monroe expires. He dies right then and there.
And these Coast Guardsmen acted as bravely as any members from any service in the entire war.
Absolutely.
And Monroe is awarded the Medal of Honor. I think he's the only Coast Guardsman ever to receive the Medal of Honor, isn't he? That's
100% correct. Yeah, he was the first one, and he's the only one so far to have received the Medal of Honor. Evans, the coxswain, gets, he's awarded the Navy Cross. But Monroe is posthumously awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor for his actions there at Point
Cruz. And Dave, I remember that you do a video where you kind of show where all this happened. And there's hotels there now, as I recall.
Yeah, it's very, very well populated. So I did one called the Little Dunkirk. This is what the...
And did you coin that name, the Little Dunkirk? Because I've never heard it called that before.
The Marines at the time called it the Little Dunkirk.
Oh, they did, okay.
Yeah. I'll have a Douglas Monroe episode just...
As well. Okay.
There's a couple other guys I want to mention in there. There was another person nominated for the Medal of Honor, but it was downgraded to Navy Cross. That was Anthony Malinowski. And he was a platoon sergeant, pre-war Marine. So they were coming off the hill. And Malinowski was there with a battalion surgeon and one of the company commanders. And they come to a clearing. And the area where I used to work in Honiara was right there. That was where my office was. right on the scene of this action, of basically when Malinowski did his action and when these guys are running down. So Malinowski's coming down. He sees a BAR, Brown Automatic Rifle, on the ground from a wounded Marine. So he jumps in this clearing, and he says, "I'll hold him off. You keep going." They go, "What are you doing?" He goes, "I'll catch up to you in a minute." So they started moving back, and they could hear him shooting the bar in a sustained, burst like a professional Marine would do, short round burst. And they heard him firing for a number of times, and then they didn't hear him fire him anymore. And then one of the other Marines, one of the last Marines down the hill, they asked him, "Did you see Malinowski?" He says, "No, he's dead." So he held off the Japanese there. There was another guy that hardly anyone knows about. He's a private called John Giles. He was a machine gunner, and he was up on the eastern spur. And Giles was holding off the last Japanese, holding off the Japanese with a light machine gun, the 1919. And he died in place too. But he was, they could hear him firing his weapon. He was the only one up there firing. So it's all kind of brave stories on these guys. But unfortunately, they're still there.
Yeah.
There's 18
of stories and your
body's unrecovered.
Yeah, and I've been on a few awards boards before, and nothing like this. I was on a Silver Star Award board once. And the question you get is, how in the heck can you justify downgrading what these guys did to Navy crosses? And just, it doesn't make sense to me today. I don't know how it made sense to them back then.
I guess maybe because nobody actually physically saw, Medal of Honor actions usually
the witness.
Officer in those days. Officer had to witness him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Casamento was another one, which was later in the campaign, was a good example of that.
Yeah. I'm so glad that policy has been revised.
Yeah. And I mean, there's countless stories of heroism on the Marine Corps side and the Army side on Guadalcanal. And these are just a few. And it seems, the more desperate the action, the more stories like this seem to come to the surface. Not that there, on any given day that this couldn't happen, but the more desperate the scenario, the more common the stories seem to seem to be, is that the Marines, this famous last words, "Oh, I'll catch up with you in a minute."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Rarely does that occur.
I'll hold them off. Right.
Yeah. Rarely.
Did Chesty get ashore from the destroyer, or did he just watch as his, that sounds too passive. He was very active, but would kind of wait as his Marines retrograded and were recovered.
Yeah, that's an interesting, I haven't been able to verify that. You hear different accounts. Knowing probably what Puller, how he was, I would say he was on one of the landing craft. He would have jumped on the landing craft to go in. He wouldn't have waited on the destroyer. Mm-hmm. There's accounts of him on the beach organizing these guys. So I believe that account. Yeah. That was the type of guy Puller was. Once he got there, he wasn't going to stay on the boat. He was going to go in there with his guys and share the danger.
Yeah, right.
So at the end of the day, this is it, because after this occurs, after they get the Marines off of the point, out of the Point Cruz area, the attack by Edson and 2-5 is done. That's it. It's pretty much over at that point.
But to summarize, the Raiders failed the envelopment on the right flank, and the amphibious envelopment failed on the left flank.
All right. Holding action failed, and the flanking action across the river by the Raiders failed.
Mm-hmm.
Is it the only defeat that the Marines had during the campaign?
And is it because the Japanese had built a defense in depth so effective that they were able to, because weren't they outnumbered at this spot?
It was a number of issues. One was obviously the planning was planned on the fly. The organization was done very quickly. Communications, fog of war, underestimation of the Japanese. This is a time where we always talk about where the Japanese underestimated the Marines, where the Marines underestimated the Japanese numbers. And effectiveness, they thought there were less than that many Japanese, because maybe it was a reconnaissance in force to start with, to find out how many Japanese were there.
Right.
These are the fresher. These are the kind. They were the Japanese that attacked. Did a one of the fight attacks on Bloody Ridge, so they weren't that heavily engaged. They were semi-fresh.
they were the freshest ones there, or among the freshest ones there.
So some of the 4th Marines, or fourth Japanese regiments were moving up, but yeah, these are the so there's a whole combination of eras.
Okay.
So the results of this are that 70 United States Marines and one Coast Guardsman are killed in action. And I should say, let me just say 70 Americans, because there's Navy corpsmen in there that could also lose their lives. And a further 100-ish are wounded in action. And as you said, Dave, this is the first time and the only time, really, that the Japanese defeat the United States Marines in a one-on-one infantry fight. And there's a message that is sent back to Japanese headquarters, and it's said that once the message was received that, you know, this is a, we stopped them here, we beat them here, that it's the first and only good news that came from Guadalcanal in terms of the Japanese at this point. After this occurs, and this is September, what was the date again? 27. Yeah, September 27th, not to be denied, a couple of weeks later, moving on down the story here, the Marines try to do a very similar thing again on the night of, on the October 6th through the 9th. This operation goes significantly better than the first. To give a little preface to this, on October the 3rd, Japanese Lieutenant General Maruyama was landed with fresh troops. His mission was to set up artillery positions on the opposite side of the Matanikau with which to shell Marine positions in preparation for the late October offensive that was on the horizon. This course becomes Battle of Henderson Field, which we'll talk about next time we're with you, Dave. Over the next few days, the Japanese proceeded to do, well, they tried to do just that, and they started probing Marine lines along that area. Now, Marines being Marines, they are also doing the same thing. We're conducting active patrols over there. Vandegrift is aware of the arrival of these fresh Japanese troops, and this is what propels him to launch yet another assault across the Matanikau, right?
Yes, yes. So they planned this one a bit better than the other one. This is basically going to replicate what they did, but better planning. This time he's going to have 5 battalions supported by air and naval guns. And then they were going to basically eliminate these Japanese from the mouth of Matanikau, because once again, they knew the Japanese were starting to land these heavy guns. And if they formed a platform on the eastern side, a gun platform on the eastern side of Matanikau, and later we'll see in October, Japanese are bringing tanks over. And that was going to be basically a launching point or attack point. That was going to be, and once you get there, once you pass that barrier of Matanikau, you can all go straight, other than the Lunga River, you can go straight to the airfield. And they wanted to, once again, like I said at the beginning, Vandegrift wanted to keep them as further away from the airfield as he could. The Japanese, at this stage, wanted to attack across the Matanikau. So their plan, they had an offensive plan for the 8th of October. The Japanese did, to take that that side and push a whole regiment, the 4th Japanese Infantry Regiment, across Matanikau and form a riverhead, so to speak, a base. And the Marines wanted to eliminate them before they could do that.
So Vandegrift sends the 5th Marines minus one five. And it's under the command of a guy named Whaling. Can you tell us about Whaling, the Whaling group? What is that?
Yeah.
Frank Whaling, isn't it?
Bill Whaling. Yeah, well, once again, a lot of these old Marine officers, World War I veteran, banana war guy. He was an avid outdoorsman, hunter, expert shooter. Whaling was the executive officer of the 5th Marines when the invasion began. And then the shake of commands couldn't have a colonel as executive officer, so they didn't want to send him back because he was very valuable. So they told Whaling to form a group of scout snipers, because that time the Marines had, they needed, they were lacking in experienced patrols, leading patrols and scouting. So they knew there was a bit of a lacking in that. So Whaling came to Vandegrift and come up with an idea. He said, look, can I go to the infantry units, pick out some of the guys with past hunting experience and scouting and patrolling experience, form a small group, give them training, train them up. Then I would use them as like forward reconnaissance guys, kind of related to the reconnaissance battalion of today's Marines. And then once I'll do that, I'll train a number of them up. I'll send some back to the units, and then they can share their knowledge and teach other guys. And once again, he started that, and the actual patrolling skills of the Marines actually improved. Mm-hmm. So Whaling was given command of this small battalion of scouts and snipers. And I'm trying my best to find more information. You'll find hardly any information on these guys. The chief scout was there called Daniel Boone. He's somebody's name, Daniel Boone. They call him Daniel Boone. He's a big giant Marine with a big red beard. And he was a legend, but kind of lost to history, his real name. I'd love to find his real name, but I'm trying my best to find out about this group. I really want to know more about him. But then he had 3rd Battalion, 2nd Marines was brought over from Tulagi to be a reserve unit. So Whalen was put in charge of the 3rd Battalion, 2nd Marines, and his small group of scout snipers, and they formed into the Whaling group.
Mm-hmm. Their goal was to, along with the 7th Marines, the Whaling group, this is, to cross the river again down there at the old fancy pants one log bridge, and to move along the area where Puller was theoretically and Edson were supposed to do that very thing the month before and envelop and entrap the Japanese. On October the 7th, the attack kicked off. 3-5 runs into, they get up to the river, and they kind of run into the same kind of a thing that they did earlier last month. They run into some pretty fierce resistance right there at the end of the river, don't they, Dave?
Yeah, so just like I said, the 4th Japanese Regiment was their plan on the 8th of October was to do offensive and push across. So what they'd done, they pushed a company, roughly, maybe I think 2 reinforced platoons, across the Matanikau to form a small riverhead. So they had a small pocket, probably about 150 meters down from the mouth, probably about 200 yards wide, and they had dug in trench positions. There was one story, and I'm trying to find out what 5 Marines there were. There was a number of stories that when the 1st Marines moved in there from the 5th Marines, some of their scouts had come upon, 5 of their scouts had been tied and bound with their hands and feet, and they're all dead. So I think that was the first scouts that the Marines had sent out, the Japanese had captured, probably tortured and killed. So they ran straight into these Japanese, thinking they're on the other side of the river, and they ran straight into this bunker complex. And the 2 companies got pinned down of 3-5, and you had 2-5 there with them on their left flank, trying to move in.
So they eventually, the Marines start to eventually gain ground there. It's slow, and they bring up half tracks with 75 millimeter artillery pieces on the inside of these half tracks, and they're firing at these Japanese emplacements almost point blank, aren't they?
Yeah, it's very thick jungle. I've got a lot of photos of the area, how it looked roughly around the same time in the same month. It's very, very thick jungle. Mm-hmm. So the half tracks could only get up through the coastal track, so they could provide limited support. A lot of this was in close fighting with hand grenades and rifles and, you know, up close and personal hand-to-hand type stuff. So they were pinned down for the whole day and over a whole night. They brought raiders up too,
but artillery is indirect fire. Were they using these artillery? Yeah, indirect. Were they using this as direct fire?
Yeah.
I mean, how do they fuse these artillery rounds to get them to detonate that quickly?
Well, they basically had the old French 75 millimeter howitzers mounted on these half tracks, and that's what they used. I'm not familiar with. I'm not an arty guy. I'm an infantry guy. Right. So I don't know how they fused them, but they were able to because they were their anti-tank capability. That's what they were designed for.
The anti-tank. Yeah. So they had some direct fire capability then.
Yeah, with the 75s.
Okay.
So by nightfall, the Marines do wind up getting through that area. They hold the mouth of the river, or at least the area in that general vicinity, and the Whaling group and the 7th Marines had crossed the river. I guess it'd be upstream by the bridge, and they had somewhat accomplished part of their mission, but they had not finished. The following afternoon, they receive more Marines coming through there. H Company, 5th Marines under Captain Rigo. These are the guys you talked about the Valley earlier, Dave. These are the guys that wind up kind of getting in between a rock and a hard place there, right?
Yeah, I'll take it one step back. The night time came, the Japanese were still there. And what happened was the raiders thought they're going to leave the island. And this time, Edson was the overall commander on the scene. So Edson says, look, I need a company of raiders to assist. Bring up the raiders. So they brought the raiders up, one company of the raiders, and they dug in at the mouth. So that night, the Japanese tried to attack out, and they did an assault kind of in the rear of the raiders' line and overran the whole mortar platoon of raiders and killed something like 12 raiders. Mm-hmm. And the Japanese, mainly died to the man trying to go across the mouth. The rest of the Marines, the 7th Marines and the whaling group, because you still had – you had 2nd Battalion, 7th Marines, and 1st Battalion, 7th Marines under Hannikin and Puller, and the whaling group, they were going to be the maneuver element. They were still across Matanikau at that stage. Mm-hmm. And then they crossed the next day on the 9th to get back to 2-5. 2-5 was on the left flank of 3-5 and the raiders. The valley, and I mentioned at the very beginning of the podcast, that was the east-west trail that went down and to the valley, then across Matanikau to One Law Bridge. So in that book, Into the Valley by John Hersey, which he was a famous war correspondent, he tells a good tale of going to that valley with H Company, which was the weapons company, and there was a couple other, obviously they were attached to G Company and another company, and they hit a good firefight. And that book, very small book, but it describes their little fight in detail. And myself and a guy called Jeff Raker from Missing Marines, and he's written a good book on Guadalcanal too, that we're doing a lot of research to find two of those Marines that's mentioned in that book that was left on the battlefield burials, bodies never recovered.
So they get in there, Rigo's people get in this valley, and they kind of realize their mistake pretty damn quick, right? I mean, they're taking fire from all, well, pretty much both sides and in the front. And there is a bit of a panicking situation here from some of the Marines. It's Hersey, which, by the way, to your point, the book Into the Valley is fantastic. If you've never read it, it's a short read. You know, you could probably read it in an afternoon, honestly, but it's absolutely outstanding. But the Marines some of the riflemen up forward start to panic, and they're realizing their predicament, and they're starting to break, and some of them are starting to run. Rigo is the one that stands up, and I remember you had said, Dave, when we were talking about Edson's Ridge, one of the best ways to stop Marines from doing something you don't want them to do is to shame them. And this is what one of the many tactics that he employs here to get his Marines to turn around, retake their positions, and hold that ground, is he starts basically chastising them, and the Marines do indeed hold that area, don't they?
Yes, yes. And that's one of the things they teach you from day one in the history and traditions. Don't be the first ones to ever run, and the guys before you never did. So that, you know, it's just esprit de corps. There's a lot of good units that teach that. And that's
almost never happened in the war. So it's not like this is a common occurrence. Mm-hmm. And it was undone in this event as well. Hmm.
So yes. The next day, the assault continues, the attack continues, and they being the Marines, eventually do, you know, accomplish their mission. On the 8th, Vandegrift receives intelligence that the Japanese, and this is important, this is why this kind of unfolds the way it does here in a minute. Vandegrift receives intelligence that the Japanese were preparing an all-out offensive to recapture the island. Again, this is kind of a, you know, harbinger for the Henderson Field battle that's coming up at the end of this month, October. As a result, he canceled the operation for the next day, and ordered his, and he wanted his to get, rightfully so, get his units back across Matanikau along the perimeter to prepare for this assault that's going to
dig in defense, right, in depth.
Right. The whaling group and 2-7 had reached the beach as Puller's group topped a ridge line to find an entire Japanese battalion in the ravine below him. So the assault is still continuing. Puller's people, this is where he really gets some killing done here, doesn't he, Dave?
Yeah, so Puller was the far left battalion. So once they crossed the Matanikau,
right,
there was this sweeping battalion. So the Wayland group takes the first ridge, then peels off first ridge. 2-7 under Hannikin peels off second ridge, and Puller, well, 1-7 is going to pull off and go to third ridge. Go downhill 66 ridge, and there's a place, it's basically called Hill 80 during a fight, and up to Hill 78, which is where the Parliament House is now, for anyone that knows Guadalcanal. Puller, he gets there, he starts to engage. They see the Japanese down there, they start to engage. Arthur Sims, who's the regimental commander of the 7th Marines, is still on the other side of Matanikau, basically orders Puller back. Puller says, look, I'm engaged in a major fight here. I can't come back. And he does the old classic Puller. He gets on the radio and says,
I can't hear you.
he did that after this, but he basically said, if you want to know what's going on, you come up here yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, instead of being back there, roughly referring to him, you're back in the rear, come up here yourself and find out. And then he just cuts the communication off.
Yeah.
Twining said these old banana war Marines, like Puller and Hannikin, had a tendency, and that's what they used to do in the banana wars. Once they left the wire, the line, so to speak, they cut off all communications. You couldn't communicate with them, which is very frustrating. But anyway, Puller gets there. They get in engaged in a major fight. So one of the fresh battalions, the Japanese 4th Regiment, was caught in this ravine. Now, if Guadalcanal today, just like then, the ridges are coral ridges, so there's not much topsoil on there. So they're very
barren. You can't really dig in.
Well, they're very barren. You don't see many trees on it. But then you'll see the barren hills, and then you have the thick jungle
in the valley.
So the Japanese used to go into the jungle ravines and low ground, because during the day, if they stayed on the high ground, the Cactus Air Force would get them. So that was the nice covered ravines. Mm-hmm. The Japanese held the low ground, and the Marines held the high ground, so to speak. But said, caught these Japanese in this ravine. And it was really only one company of the Marines, of the 1st Battalion, 7th Marine C Company, was really engaged. So what they were doing was they were dropping the 60-millimeter mortars in on ends of the ravines. And if you look to the ravine to this day, it's very steep on both sides. And they were pinning the Japanese, and the Japanese were trying to get out on the other side, and he had his machine gun set up, and they were killing the Japanese. And, Puller basically said, worst effect is an extermination, or it was a machine for extermination he had designed. And they were killing them all. And then it started to drop in some of the 75-millimeter artillery in the Marines in that area too. Now, what was very unique about that, the amount of Japanese they killed in there, Puller's one company of Marines killed about as many Japanese in an hour and a half than, you know, 2 days at Bloody Ridge and 1 day at Alligator Creek by holding, you know, 2 times. That just shows how many of the Japanese they killed. They killed roughly, from Japanese estimates, this is from Japanese, obviously you probably won't find the exact account, but anywhere between 600 to 700 Japanese. So basically destroyed that whole battalion.
So was the intelligence that Vandegrift had that the Japanese were going to conduct an all-out attack to retake the island, was that intelligence correct?
Oh, yes. Once again, it goes back to what I'm really dwelling into in one of your past podcasts with the naval admiral with the intelligence. It was a good podcast, and it really referred to how the top level intelligence we're dealing with. So we're dealing with, you know, ultra or magic, you know, the Japanese naval code. And that's where a lot of this information was coming from. Japanese, breaking the Japanese radio codes and radio traffic and everything. So that was the information. You read the accounts of time he received intelligence, but that was the intelligence they were getting, that level. Exactly.
And did this action by Puller's battalion defeat that attempt to retake the island?
Oh, no, not in that one, because this was information that the Japanese, and you'll see later, Battle of Henderson Field, that the Japanese were coming to everything they got, with the largest fleet since Midway, a whole reinforced division.
Right,
they
see
everything they got down.
Stay tuned.
But it defeated the Japanese offensive plan for the 8th to establish that artillery base on the eastern side of Matanikau. It basically destroyed the 4th Regiment. Well, it didn't destroy it.
Damn near.
It decimated it.
And rendered them ineffective for the for the rest of the campaign, really. I mean, we see them fighting a bit later, but yeah, it hurt them.
But the victory here is not so much the intelligence, because that comes to play later. It's the fact that they denied denied the Japanese that artillery position, which was the only reason that the Japanese wanted that artillery position on the other side of the Matanikau, was to support the offensive that's coming up at the end of the month of October, which of course is the Battle for Henderson Field. We said it back in the Edson's Ridge episode, that after Edson's Ridge, you know, if there is a turning point in the, you know, again, turning point, such a sticky
term. In the Pacific War.
Yeah. But if there's a turning point on the land campaign for Guadalcanal, you know, it would probably be after Edson's Ridge, because this is when the Japanese decide to send the kitchen sink at Guadalcanal. You know, they're kind of doing it piecemeal here and there, but this is when they send the kitchen sink. This is when they send everything. And it's all in preparation for this October 20th, you know, the Henderson Field event. This is all in preparation for that. And this particular attack across Matanikau denies the Japanese that artillery position. It kills over 700 of the enemy that absolutely would have been used in that assault against Henderson Field, no doubt. And it puts a dent in their plans, but it does not stop those plans, right, Dave?
Yeah, exactly right. And to deny the Japanese another further attempt across Matanikau at that stage, after the Marines pulled back, Vandegrift left two battalions in a horseshoe shape, fish hook shaped. Defense line on the Matanikau itself. So he's left two four battalions on the east side of Matanikau to keep the Japanese, and they're getting ready for the Japanese then.
And getting back to your point, Seth, with the Japanese are reinforcing Guadalcanal when they made a decision to this shall not stand, and we're not going to allow the Americans to keep it, and so they're initially trying to bring transports down. And of course, the Cactus Air Force defeats that. And now they're starting to bring reinforcements in by fast destroyer down the slot.
Down the slot, yeah.
And so that's what's happening, trying to build up forces so they could retake Guadalcanal.
Absolutely.
And at this point, it's a battle of attrition, it feels like, in order to keep that force that's being built up from having overwhelming authority into retaking.
Yeah, we're just talking about the land stuff here. At the same time, all this is going on, as you guys know, and you discussed the naval stuff. There's naval actions going on, and more importantly, too, there's a lot of air action going on at this stage, and there's just a major air action going on that we even discussed, which is that's why it's so great about the Guadalcanal campaign. It's that three dimensional that you could go three different ways.
Yeah,
in depth.
And every single aspect, air, land, and sea, affects the other.
That's correct.
If the United States doesn't hold air superiority during the day, and I don't want to say we don't necessarily hold air superiority during the day, because air superiority defined is that we control every aspect of the air.
And we didn't,
because the Japanese still got bombing raids in and you know, things like that. But by and large, we do own a great portion of the skies during the day.
If you don't control the air, you don't control the seas.
Right.
And if you don't control the seas, you can't reinforce the Marines and get more Marines ashore.
Exactly.
So you're right. It's dominoes here.
Absolutely.
And happily, we did have reasonable, not full, air superiority. We had, you know, what you're talking about, we never had air supremacy.
Right.
We had air superiority that was kind of migrant. It came in and went almost on an hour by hour basis, but enough to allow us to hold control of seas. Again, not 24/7 throughout, right?
Right.
As Savo Island proved, and Cape Esperance, which we'll talk about later, but enough to finally get some Marines ashore and some logistics support ashore for this battle.
Right.
And which is going to allow us to prevail in the long run, but more on that later.
And you know, the unsinkable aircraft carrier that is Henderson Field forces the Japanese to move their people at night. because, right, you know, this is where the, you know, Tokyo Express and the people coming down the slot, this is all because of the fact that anything that moves during the day, the Japanese are terrified that it's going to get hit by SBDs or Avengers or B-17s or whatever that are going to strike them during the day. So everything affects the other thing here on Guadalcanal. And it's a, you know, there is no battle for Guadalcanal. You know, there is the campaign, and this is just one of the many battles within the campaign, and they all affect everything that follows afterwards.
There's one thing I don't think I've mentioned in the other podcast, that one of the reasons I found it very fascinating, it's roughly the only time in the whole Pacific War where the forces were roughly even.
Right.
It's parity. It's kind of like an even playing field.
Right.
Obviously, see, at the very beginning, the Japanese were kind of overwhelming, and obviously at the end, the Allies were overwhelming. But at this stage, parity on land, sea, and air, they're roughly about the same.
They are, and you see that. I think you see that more at sea, because, I mean, you know, like Cape Esperance, you know, it was a pretty even gunfight. You know, the Battle of Cape Esperance, it really was. It was a pretty evenly matched gunfight. And Savo Island, theoretically, you know, we held more guns, but that's another story. But yeah, you're right, Dave, 100%. This is really the only time in the Pacific War that there is parity, that it is a mano-a-mano kind of a thing. Man-to-man, airplane-to-airplane, ship-to-ship. And there's only a couple times where we heavily outnumber them or they heavily outnumber us, but such as it is. But, you know, these are two battles, the Matanikau actions here, that are not extremely well known. But again, they influence things that happen later. And we're building up to this big event that's coming at the end of this month. And by this month, I'm talking about the month of October 1942. And that's the battle for Henderson Field, which is, Dave, I mean, we'll talk about it when we talk about that battle. But I think it's fair to say that that's probably one of the final nails in the Imperial coffin at Guadalcanal, is the October battles.
Almost the high point.
Yeah.
High point of the Japanese offensive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Pacific. I mean, if you don't count the China, Burma, India, or, you know, that field, I think they only did one more really offensive attack, and that was in Bougainville. But other than that, this was the high water mark of the Japanese offensive operations in the Pacific, right here. And then that October battle. And Neil, what if, you know, we can discuss it later with the November battle, if that would have occurred.
I always find it symbolic that Bougainville is where Yamamoto ends up dying.
Yeah.
But this October battle, we'll find out Yamamoto had his full attention, attention. The high Japanese, this was the number one priority in the Japanese. This October battle, this was it of Guadalcanal.
This is where Emperor Hirohito personally inserts himself into the Japanese plans here.
They sent their best to Guadalcanal. The Japanese sent their best.
Again, defeating the myth that Hirohito was only peripherally aware of how the war was going, that he wasn't really involved. Yes, he was.
Absolutely, he was. Well, gentlemen, unless you got something else you want to add, I think that's a pretty good place to wrap this sucker up.
Agreed.
What do you think, Dave?
Oh, that's good. And yeah, I had a good chat once again. I love chatting about Guadalcanal.
Bill, you got anything else you want
to? No. There's more to come.
There is certainly more to come. Dave, you're going to join us for our Henderson Field Talk, right?
Yes, I really look forward to that one. A few good stories.
Oh, yeah.
One last thing I do.
John Bassalone.
Bassalone.
Oh, yeah. The Mitchell Page. And all
Mitch Page.
Yeah, as an Italian-American growing up, I got to tell you, I knew the name Bassalone. But before we leave this episode, though, I do want to say one thing about Chesty Puller, because I knew his son. In the 1990 to 92 time frame, I was stationed on the Joint Staff, and Lewis Puller Jr. was a Pentagon lawyer that I worked with just peripherally, but I knew him. And of course, he had been a Vietnam veteran, lost his legs and part of both of his hands to a landmine, I think it was, in Vietnam. Very famously wrote a book called Fortunate Son that won the Pulitzer Prize after I stopped working for him. I think that was in 92 or 93. And sadly, committed suicide in 94. And that really, one of those suicides that's affected me over the years. But imagine being Chesty Puller's son. You've got to live up to that example. He joined the Marine Corps, served in Vietnam, was blown up, And really, I think nobody paid attention to PTSD back then. And happily, we pay more attention to it today, but certainly still today, not enough. But he clearly suffered from PTSD for decades and sadly decided to end his life. And I say about Captain McVeigh of the USS Indianapolis fame, people call suicide a permanent solution to a temporary problem. In McVeigh's case, he'd been dealing with the events surrounding the Indianapolis for 23 years when he committed suicide. He did not see it as a temporary problem.
Right.
And of course, with Lewis Pooler Jr., he's never going to get his legs back and his hands, and he's never always suffered from pain and went through issues with alcohol abuse and painkiller abuse and realizing that this is never going to change. Such a sad story. And a sad end to such a proud heritage for not just the Marine Corps, but for America. And if you haven't read Lewis Pooler Jr.'s book called Fortunate Son, I really do encourage you to read it, because it really closes it. I say close the chapter on the Lewis Pooler saga, but I'm not sure it does. I think that it continues for every veteran suffering from PTSD today. And very much worth a read.
That's hard to follow up, Bill.
Yeah. But it needed to be said.
It does. And that is something that is far too often forgotten, is the remnants of battle, the remnants of war. And I'm not just talking about, a battlefield.
As we're here in a future episode, even Lewis Pooler Sr., Chesty Pooler, wasn't immune from these issues, right? And so no one is superhuman. Every one of these people we're talking about is a human being who's going to suffer from what they see, what they're exposed to, what they've gone through, the decisions that they have to make through the course of the war. And not even the famous, iconic Chesty Pooler was immune.
Absolutely.
No, you're right. And once again, there's a lot of support now for that. And obviously, if anyone's suffering from that, they can reach out and get support. And the best thing to do is just to talk to people about it.
Yeah, I'm very critical of VA for a whole bunch of reasons. But this is one area I think they do a good job. The Veterans Administration support line for people that are dealing with PTSD and anybody who thinks they want to harm themselves is very good.
So reach out and get support if you're suffering, talk to people.
There's absolutely
a lot of help out there.
Absolutely. And with that, we want to thank you for listening in on our conversation. Please subscribe to the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast wherever you receive your podcasts and give us a rating and review. We would certainly and do appreciate it. Also, if you want to see the video version of this and any of our other episodes, subscribe to our YouTube channel called The Unauthorized History of the Pacific War Podcast, and also look us up on Facebook, like and subscribe to our page as well. Also, once again, Dave, follow up on Dave's YouTube channel called Guadalcanal Walking a Battlefield. Dave, you got the Facebook page too, right?
Yes.
You're still posting stuff on there every couple of days. I see things pop up on there. It's a fantastic resource, both Facebook and YouTube. Dave's pages, Guadalcanal Walking a Battlefield. Check them out.
Dave's videos are a national treasure for anybody really interested in these battle. I mean, there's nothing like seeing the actual places, and Dave takes you there. So I really do encourage people to go visit his YouTube channel in particular, where those videos are incredible.
For those of us who cannot get to Guadalcanal, of which I am one, this is as close as you're probably. Say again.
Hopefully you'll get there one day.
Yeah, I'd love to get
there. I can take you there one day.
Absolutely.
Hell yeah, that's a date, man.
Like a soul room.
This is as close as you're going to get to being there. They're absolutely fantastic, and I watch them often, actually. If you do have a question for us, please send us an email at unauthorizedpacificpodcast@gmail.com. And once again, my name is Seth Paradin, and I want to say thank you very much for tuning in this week, Bill.
Yeah, thanks, everybody, and go check out Dave's videos.
Yep. Well, everybody, thank you very much for listening and watching, and we'll see you next week.